I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Neuroradiologist Scott Atlas has become an influential player on the White House Coronavirus Task Force, having been tapped for the job by President Trump after seeing him on Fox News. Contradicting just about every public health expert, Atlas has questioned expanded testing, has claimed that masks and social distancing to prevent viral transmission don't work, and has promoted something called herd immunity to combat the pandemic that scientists and physicians have called dangerous. Here he is on The Blaze on October 14th.
We can allow a lot of people to get infected, those who are not at risk to die or have a serious hospital requiring illness. We should be fine with letting them get infected, generating immunity on their own, and the more immunity in the community, the better we can eradicate the threat of the virus, including the threat to people who are vulnerable. That's what herd immunity is.
We asked Yasmin Abutaleb, Washington Post health policy reporter, to join us. She's one of the authors of an investigation into how Atlas has become a disruptive force on the White House Coronavirus Task Force and how he has the president's ear. Yasmin Abutaleb, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, you can always join us during this hour. You can email us at whyy.org/radiotimes. You can also send us, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Scott Atlas, a former chief of neuroradiology at Stanford University Medical Center. He's a fellow at the Hoover Institute. He has been an expert on Fox News. How did he get this job on the task force? What was he saying that President Trump felt was so compelling?
Well, over the spring and the summer, the president and some of his advisors, including his son-in-law and senior advisor, Jared Kushner, saw his Fox News appearances where he was adamantly arguing against lockdowns. He was saying that there was no reason not to reopen schools because children don't suffer serious complications from the virus, which, of course, is not entirely true. There are children who, have serious cases of the virus. He said falsely that children don't spread the virus. And he was basically calling for a full reopening with very, very few restrictions. He also questioned the science around masks and wanted, he kept pointing to Sweden, which has adopted, fewer restrictions than most other countries, including the U.S., including most European countries, as a model, basically was saying it's time for life to go back to normal. And the president really liked this idea of having someone with a medical degree arguing the things that he had been trying to argue for several months. Obviously all the doctors on the task force wanted public health measures in place, wanted a more measured approach. And here he sort of had someone giving him what seemed like a medical justification for reopening with very few restrictions and basically not having to deal with the virus anymore.
Well, he does have a medical degree, but he does not have any experience in, contagious diseases or viral pandemics. Was the president looking for someone to counter Fauci and Birx and Redfield and others?
He was. We wrote an article back in September, shortly after Dr. Atlas first arrived. And one of the things was that he has sort of fashioned himself as an anti-Dr. Fauci. Dr. Fauci's obviously become a face of this response. He's has much less influence now than he did earlier. But because even as the president and some of his aides were downplaying the virus, Dr. Fauci always advocated for public health measures, always said that it was very serious and that people needed to act accordingly. And Dr. Atlas has been sort of the opposite of that. He's, in that clip you played, he talks about how young people don't have serious cases of the disease, so why not let them get infected and let the population more naturally build up to herd immunity, which, is for every infectious disease outbreak, the approach to get to herd immunity has been through a vaccine, not letting tons of people get infected, because you then have a lot of extra hospitalizations. Even if you don't die from COVID, there are people who have very serious cases of the disease for weeks and months. And then, of course, you will have hundreds of thousands of excess deaths if you sort of just let it run rampant like that.
But we heard in that clip, I mean, the idea that if you're a healthy person, you don't live with an unhealthy person. I mean, it is a kind of Darwinian survival of the fittest approach to this pandemic.
Right, right. And you know, there's this talking point of, well, we'll protect the most vulnerable, we'll direct resources to the most vulnerable, and let everyone else get it. And the thing that experts point to is, you know, and actually the doctors within the task force have as well have pushed back on him in meetings about this, is the most vulnerable people do not all live in nursing homes. Plenty of them live in the same households as people who are healthy and are at much lower risk for a serious complication of the virus. So, I mean, logistically, it's impossible to section off the vulnerable of the population. And if you're including people with pre-existing conditions and underlying health conditions, that's about a third of the U.S. population from the young and healthy. And the other thing is, this virus has been around for less than a year. It does seem like plenty of people get it and have fairly mild cases and don't have very serious complications. There are, you know, unexpected complications and plenty of patients. And so, you know, there is a risk in just letting it run rampant without fully understanding what the consequences may be.
He did put something on Twitter, masks work, ? No, ! To the point where Twitter actually removed his tweet.
Right. And he was linking to an article from an institution called the American Institute for Economic Research. It's this libertarian think tank where this declaration was signed called the Great Barrington Declaration that essentially advocated for a herd immunity strategy. And that article, you know, sort of downplayed the threat of the virus, you know, talked about how people were being hysterical, and that tweet was flagged by lots of public health experts and doctors and epidemiologists and others who said this was, you know, misinformation that could kill people. And then Twitter eventually responded and took it down for violating a misinformation policy.
You describe really how he, frankly, has disrupted much of what has gone on at the task force. And the task force includes Dr. Birx, for instance, who is kind of heading up the response from the White House. What has been the relationship between Dr. Birx and Dr. Atlas?
So that one has been, I think, probably the most acrimonious of the relationships between the doctors. Most of the doctors on the task force do disagree with Dr. Atlas, but Dr. Birx, from what we understand, argues with him the most forcefully. And part of that is because her job as the White House coronavirus response coordinator is to look at the data, analyze it, and then she'll craft charts and graphs, and she'll show that there are upticks in many parts of the country, and here are the regions of the country that we really need to be worried about. And Dr. Atlas has pushed back on her and her data analysis in a lot of these meetings and said, that's not true. We're almost through it. It's almost over. We're going to be through this in the next few weeks. And they get in these pretty heated policy debates over, you know, what the science does and does not show and how different parts of the country should be responding to surges. I think one of the things that the doctors, especially Dr. Birx and Dr. Fauci, find most frustrating is that Dr. Atlas often says that places like New York or Miami or Chicago, you know, parts of the country that have been really hard hit by the virus are done. They're not going to be hard hit again because they've reached a herd immunity level. And of course, no one knows what that level is. And right. The evidence doesn't indicate that the U.S. as a whole is close to herd immunity at all. And they get in these arguments where, you know, they feel he's advocating these fringe scientific theories that don't really have evidence to back them up. They're citing what most of the scientific community agrees with. And Vice President Pence and other political advisors on the task force basically say, well, there's a disagreement. They should go work it out.
Go work it out. But the evidence, it seems to me, is in Dr. Birx's court. I mean, we just, you know, we're seeing soaring numbers in most states across the country, including here in Pennsylvania, also in New Jersey. So when it comes to an argument, doesn't the fact that we're seeing such an increase, both in numbers, but also in the number of people who have died, that they kind of speak for themselves?
I think that's the argument that they would make, that the data and most of the scientific community backs up what they are saying. I think the challenge here is that you do have a White House that very much wants to move past this virus, is very focused on the campaign and the president's reelection. And you've seen the president in the past few days attacking Dr. Fauci, mocking Vice President Biden for saying he would listen to the scientists and he would listen to Dr. Fauci saying that people are sick of coronavirus. I mean, you can see in the president's public statements, that they want to move past this. There really is a desire to not be dealing with this anymore and to basically declare it over.
Yasmin, let me get a caller to join our conversation. Talking with Yasmin Abutaleb, Washington Post health policy reporter, talking about an article that she co-wrote headlined Trump's Den of Dissent Inside the White House Task Force as Coronavirus Surges. Paul, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you very much. First of all, I just have to say about the herd immunity that you were just talking about. It sounds like people have been reinfected, and this might wind up being something like the flu where you do have to get a shot every year, which is something that, we're pretty good at with the flu. It's not a problem once you get something that counteracts it. But my real question is that President Trump for weeks, maybe even a couple of months, lied about this virus, about its lethality, about its seriousness. And people listened to him and believed him. And they paid with their lives. He really disseminated dangerous, very dangerous, false information for his own benefit. And a couple of people, Dr. Fauci and to a certain extent Vice President Biden, have very gingerly stepped up to that and said, well, yes, he has some responsibility here. But I don't hear anyone like, for example, let's say mainstream person like, let's say, David Muir on national TV say anything to the effect, Mr. Trump, you have deaths to account, to your account. I just wonder what you all think about that.
Sure. I mean, I have heard other people say that as well, but it's an interesting point, Paul. Thank you for calling from Levittown. Yasmin, does that ever get discussed at the task force at the White House?
I'm not sure to what degree that specifically gets discussed in the task force. There is this balancing act that I think everyone feels they're doing where they don't want to directly criticize the president, but also want him to change the way he's discussing it. There have been a lot of pushes to get him to speak more seriously about it. And you've seen it emerge once in a while where, at one point this summer, he said it's going to get worse before it gets better. But what you see is a lot of message discipline lacking. It never lasts for very long. And there have been several pushes to get him to speak more seriously about this, to model good behavior for people so that people see him wearing a mask and social distancing. And of course, that hasn't happened in a lot of cases. I think the clearest example is obviously when the president and several of his aides got infected, and a lot of those infections seem to be tied to that September 26th Rose Garden event. And you did see Dr. Fauci speaking pretty candidly about that earlier this week, that they weren't taking proper precautions, and he thought nothing good could come from that. But I'm not sure to what degree the task force is talking about the degree to which President Trump bears responsibility because of his rhetoric early and throughout this response.
Yes, we have to take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. A recent investigation by the Washington Post found that the White House has largely abandoned fighting the pandemic and is rife with infighting, undermining their coronavirus task force. We're talking with Yasmin Abutaleb, one of the authors of that investigation, about the Trump administration's coronavirus response and how Trump advisor Dr. Scott Atlas has derailed public health efforts, even promoting dubious and discredited approaches to managing the pandemic. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Yasmin, let me go back to you, and let me ask you about Vice President Pence. Now, he heads up the White House Coronavirus Task Force. Where do some of these disagreements, these disruptions, where has that left the vice president?
So, you know, Dr. Birx brought her concerns about Dr. Atlas to the vice president's office in the last few weeks, and basically told him that she thought Dr. Atlas was a disruptive force on the task force, that he was giving the president bad and misleading information, and that she thought he should be removed from the task force. And, you know, she basically was told to that the two of them should bring data bolstering their points, and they should work out the disagreements among themselves. So I don't think that that meeting or that airing of concerns really changed anything, or I don't know that she felt, you know, very heard. I think there, what we've been told is that there's generally not a lot of willingness from the vice president to sort of help resolve these disagreements. He says that they should, you know, bring the data, make their arguments, and then they need to work it out. And that this has happened in task force meetings as well.
But he heads up the task force. Does he make the ultimate decision about what is the message coming from the White House about the pandemic?
I don't know that there is a lot of coordination about the message that should be coming from the White House. I mean, obviously the president is going to say what he's going to say. And I think what you've seen for a few months now is that depending on the official who's speaking, it's a different message. You saw Dr. Birx this summer saying the virus is everywhere, and then the president getting angry at her for that. You've seen Dr. Fauci speaking about it much more seriously than Dr. Atlas or the president or the vice president. So at this point, I think the message really depends on who's delivering it.
And the way you and your co-authors wrote this article, it sounds like the task force is more advising governors and states than coming up with some kind of federal response to the pandemic.
Right. I mean, in the beginning of the pandemic, for the first couple of months, the task force had this huge role. You know, they were very visible with these daily press conferences. What we understand from our reporting is that it really is kind of a shell of what it was earlier in this response. It still meets and convenes. It's not making a lot of decisions about what's happening on a federal level. You have Dr. Birx traveling around the country to different states to help advise them on what to do, especially these states experiencing surges. But in terms of a federal response, the task force is not playing a huge role in that anymore.
You talked to something like 41 people for this investigation. Was anyone on the record on that?
There are people who are quoted in the record in that article. It's mostly experts or, you know, former administration officials, you know, sort of discussing about what this all means and what the consequences are. Of course, when you're speaking to people who are still in the administration and still have to work for the president or whoever, they generally speak on background.
And has the CDC been sidelined?
The CDC has been sidelined. I think that's pretty evident in not just the fact that they're not really that visible, but I think in the public treatment of Dr. Redfield. You know, Dr. Redfield, a few weeks ago, had testified on Capitol Hill that about 90% of the country still remained vulnerable to the virus based on an antibody study the CDC had conducted. And Dr. Atlas, you know, as well as the president, publicly refuted him from the White House podium, saying he was wrong or he was confused. And when Dr. Atlas was pressed and said, well, which one of you is right? You're saying different things. Dr. Atlas said, I'm talking about the science. So I think it's evident in how they publicly treat Dr. Redfield, the director of the CDC.
Well, Yasmeen Abutaleb, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. She's health policy reporter for The Washington Post, and we did post The Washington Post article on our Facebook page. Well, there have been more than 400,000 new cases of COVID-19 diagnosed in the U.S. in the last week, a sign that the coronavirus pandemic has much of the country in its grip. The cooler fall weather has meant more indoor activities, and with winter weeks away, many are saying they have had it with all the restrictions. President Trump said as much in a campaign call this week, blaming Dr. Anthony Fauci for the crisis we're in. Here's a clip from that call with Fauci's response.
People are tired of hearing Fauci and all these idiots, these people that have gotten it wrong. Fauci's a nice guy. He's been here for 500 years. Every time he goes on television, there's always a bomb, but there's a bigger bomb if you fire him. But Fauci's a disaster.
It's like in The Godfather, nothing personal, strictly business. As far as I'm concerned, you know, I just want to do my job and take care of the people of this country. That's all I want to do.
We asked University of Pennsylvania epidemiologist Carolyn Canusio to tell us how to prepare for the months ahead, the importance of contact tracing, and why masks are still a point of contention. She's an epidemiologist, director of research at the University of Pennsylvania Center for Public Health Initiatives, heads the contact tracing program for Penn Medicine. And Carolyn Canusio, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much. It's good to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. And I should say, joining us by Skype. And again, to our listeners, you can join us, whyy.org/radiotimes. You can tweet us at whyyradiotimes. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. I have to say, I myself, and I think everyone that I talk to has said the same thing, which is we just feel burned out trying to deal with this crisis and deal with it, I would say, at this point, rather unsuccessfully. Do you share some of that concern and frustration?
Absolutely. I think it's very normal for all of us to be exhausted, weary, done with this thing. But it's also true that we have to dig deep and find the resolve and the reserve to prepare for the next few months because the pandemic isn't done with us.
Well, clearly, and that's one of the reasons we wanted you on the show. But let me just sort of add to the frustration. And I think for people, and I would include myself, who have frankly taken steps to limit human contact, have canceled Thanksgiving plans, you know, wear masks, socially distance, don't go to bars. I mean, you're doing the things that you and others have told us to do. Feeling a sense of frustration when we see that many other people are not doing that. And we see these numbers going up, which they are.
Absolutely. We're at a very difficult moment in the pandemic for all the reasons you've described. I want our listeners to focus on something, though, that I think is being lost because people are so tired. Right now in Pennsylvania, we're averaging about 1,000 new cases a day. That puts us back in the spring in terms of risk of community transmission. So think back to April and May, what we were doing. We were all locked down at home. It was clear what we were supposed to be doing. Everybody knew that if we had to go out for work, we were allowed to go out for work. We went out for exercise and groceries and medical care, and that was about it. So the guidelines were pretty clear, but still we were seeing high case counts. Right now, we have an emergency brewing, but I think people aren't as aware of the high risk of community transmission. So what we see in our work as contact tracers is very interesting to me as a scientist and as a human being. We see that there are many people like you and like me who have decided on household policies that are pretty strict and not so different from the lockdown policies that were imposed upon us by our local and state authorities. Right now, we don't have those outside policies set by our municipality, our city, for example. So people are really interpreting differently what constitutes safe pandemic interaction. And while lots and lots of people are restricting their face-to-face social interactions, what we're learning is that it really doesn't take a lot of people or a lot of households interacting quite a bit to introduce risk to so many of us. And I can talk about that more if you want.
I do. And what you just said, I scribbled down about five different follow-up questions. But let me ask you about masks. We are told to wear masks. It's not an onerous thing, if I can be so bold to say that, to put a mask on your face. And yet somehow masks have become this bone of contention. How do we understand that? And how do we get that person who says it's a hoax, masks, you know, are going to make you sick? How do you counter that to convince someone who's very suspicious about how and why to wear a mask?
Such an interesting question, and it's complicated, obviously. Sure. But I want to celebrate something about Philadelphia here. because actually in Philadelphia, we are doing a pretty darn good job as a city of mask wearing and mask adherence. Yes. And you see it when you go out. When I go out and exercise in the city, I see so many masks, and I want to cheer for my neighbors because I think it really is a sign of love and care and concern for one's neighbors and family and friends. So Philadelphia also tracks mask wearing through what could be considered a controversial approach, which is to look at security camera footage from public locations. And I haven't looked at the numbers this week, but in recent weeks, it looked like about 3/4 of Philadelphians were adhering to proper mask use outside, and an even higher proportion of Philadelphians were adhering to proper mask use in retail locations. And that's great, because that kind of social norm is self-reinforcing. When people see that their peers are wearing masks, there's more social pressure to wear a mask. You're the outsider. You're the sort of, to use the word, deviant. I don't really like that word.
that's loaded.
Yeah, that's loaded. So I don't mean it with that degree of oomph, but you do stand out if you're the person who's not wearing a mask. Mm-hmm. So obviously, this has become an issue that's highly variable across the country, and it's become linked to politics, unfortunately. And I think we can't ignore that our president and vice president and our elected officials are sending really undermining messages that are not helpful to public health, and they're turning it into a battle. And I think that Americans, we have to, not just Americans, but all of us on this globe, we're facing a common threat. We should be unified about layering on all the strategies that may help to reduce that threat. So when we look at the Rose Garden ceremony for the nomination of the new Supreme Court justice, and all, so many elected and appointed officials and dignitaries didn't wear masks, it was a moment for public health people. You saw Dr. Fauci put his head in his hands in sort of despair. And I think that epitomized the way many of us were feeling when we looked at that big public show.
Caroline, let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's University of Pennsylvania social epidemiologist Caroline Canusio, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Again, I've got a lot of things, but just a quick follow-up to that. So we saw that that super spreader event at the White House, and who got sick? I mean, it's, you know, there's the experiment right in front of our eyes.
Yeah, there were a few experiments going on there that I think are important for us to learn from. And one is that super spreader events do happen. So it's true that many people who get COVID will not transmit to a lot of people. It looks from the data like about 80% of the people with COVID won't transmit onward to many more people. But for reasons that we don't fully understand yet, a subset of people with COVID, maybe 20%, will transmit to a lot of people. So there were a lot of bad things that accumulated in that Rose Garden ceremony, including the lack of masking, including the crowding, including visiting inside, and including a testing strategy that failed to provide a barrier to the introduction of the virus. But also layered on there is a dose of bad luck. And this can happen, that we have someone who's there and who's highly infectious, and it turns out that that was the wrong day to have your highly infectious guest because you're crowding people into an indoor space. You're sitting right next to each other for a long period of time. You're kissing, you're hugging, you're not wearing masks. So it's a recipe for disaster.
Here's an email from Warren in the suburban Collegeville area. I see good mask wearing in my neighborhood, but masks are so cheap, $20. Why doesn't the government just send everyone 5 masks a week or get a coupon or something? Would that be helpful, just to have, you know, every week in the mail? We still get mail, I guess, in the mail.
Right.
a fresh new set of masks.
I love the way the listener is thinking about this, because with masks, as with many aspects of public health interventions, we want to think about designing the interventions in ways that make it easier for people to adhere to our recommendations. So I think it's a great idea to put masks, for example, in public places like subway stations, where people might find themselves and all of a sudden realize, oh, my goodness, I forgot my mask. And to be able to just pick one up there would be super helpful. Or if people go to restaurants, or if they show up at the workplace, yes, provide the masks, make it easy for people to do what's right. Often people want to do the right thing and they have limited bandwidth to remember all of the mitigating strategies we're supposed to be engaged in. And sometimes people accidentally leave their masks at home.
Sure. Been there, done that. You mentioned testing. Is testing overrated?
Oh my goodness. I have strong feelings about this. So let's use the example of the outbreak in the White House and the corridors of power. I think there was the mistaken impression there that if there was just enough testing, that any new case would be identified and outbreaks would be prevented. So the problem is our tests are not perfect, and false negatives can truly happen. And it's highly consequential in some circumstances to miss a person who is actually positive but tests negative, okay? The other thing is that someone who's got an infection brewing could test negative today and they could test positive tomorrow. So testing can lull us into a false sense of security. And I have heard about people, including people I love very much, who are using testing as a way to engage with vulnerable family members. So actually a family member called me last night and said, one of our loved ones, a young person, went to a party. It turned out that several people at that party tested positive for COVID. Our loved one was notified by the health department, actually developed a fever, went to get a test, tested negative, use that information to then go visit other family members of ours.
You know what? Hold on to that thought. I hate to do this only because we're on a break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Getting a coronavirus update with Carolyn Canusio. She's an epidemiologist, director of research at the University of Pennsylvania Center for Public Health Initiative. She heads up the contact tracing program for Penn Medicine. We've been talking about some of the pros and cons of testing. I do want to talk about contact tracing and also how to create a safe pod as the winter months approach. And again, you can join us, whyy.org/radiotimes. You can tweet us, WHYY Radio Times, and you can give us a call, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Carolyn Canusio, we were talking right before the break about you got a phone call from someone saying, you know, basically sort of putting testing on the table, whether that's a good thing or bad. Can you just finish your comment there?
Sure. So a loved one basically went to a party with people who tested positive for COVID. She then developed symptoms and got a test and tested negative. So then she continued her contact with other people. Later, she tested positive. So my message to all listeners is layer on your prevention strategies. Never act like the test is absolutely perfect. It's not your free pass to do whatever you want. That can put other people at risk. If you are exposed to someone with COVID, get yourself into quarantine for 2 weeks. That means stay away from other people.
Well, let's talk a little bit about contact tracing. And one of the job descriptions I ran into in preparation for the show, which is it's part psychiatrist, part detective, part problem solver. And I thought, boy, those are really very sophisticated skills. What kind of skills do you think you need to have if you're a contact tracer?
You need to have the ability to build a relationship very quickly with someone who might be skeptical about why they're talking to you in the first place. So that's why that job description includes the psychiatrist part, because it's really about reading people and trying to understand what their fears and concerns are, trying to allay those fears and concerns, and trying to engage them really as partner scientists in figuring out what's going on with the pandemic. So I think it's very important for contact tracers to be so compassionate and curious. You have to be pretty willing to ask difficult questions and pretty okay with hearing lots of different kinds of answers, because people are going to be telling you about personal aspects of their lives.
Do people, though, want to open up to a, I mean, obviously these require very good interpersonal skills, but are people willing to open up to a stranger, so to speak, about maybe some more intimate details of their personal life?
So there's this prevailing narrative in the news about contact tracing that people aren't willing to speak with contact tracers. And while there is variation, many people are very interested in stopping transmission, and they really want to talk it through and figure out, how did I get infected? And how can I make sure I didn't infect anyone else? It's such a burden for people to carry when they have COVID. There's a lot of anguish that we hear among people who are so worried that they may have exposed children in their care, for example, or they may have exposed their elderly loved ones. So I did some contact tracing calls yesterday, and I had calls that lasted for 2 hours. And people really want to be partners in talking through, okay, what are all the places I could have been exposed, and what are all the places where I could have exposed someone else?
And my understanding is that if you were within 6 feet of an infected person and spent 15 minutes with them, is that the criteria?
That's the firm guideline that CDC provides. I want people to understand, though, that that's just a benchmark that we use to operationalize our discussions. But you can imagine circumstances in which people are, for example, in an enclosed space for a very long period of time, in which the 6-foot rule may become less important. So there has been controversy about this, but the scientific community, epidemiologists, are really beginning to think that over, you know, a relatively short range, there may be transmission through breathing shared air, essentially. So you've probably heard about an outbreak that occurred among singers in a choir in Washington State. People weren't spitting on each other there. They were singing loudly in an enclosed room for a long period of time, and even people who weren't within 6 feet became ill.
Test, trace, isolate. That's the kind of mantra. Can contact tracers, can they check up on compliance? Is that part of their job?
That's a great question, and it's something we're interested in at Penn in our Center for Public Health Initiatives and in our Center for Health Incentives and Behavioral Economics. We really want to understand the behavioral aspects of these challenges, because think about it, in all of those elements, the testing and participation in testing, the tracing and the engagement with the contact tracers, the willingness to talk with them, and then the isolation, you know, staying at home, even if you're not symptomatic, all of those include such behavioral challenges. So we've been asking people in interviews about the challenges that they face with engaging in those behaviors. And we hear lots of interesting things, and I have opinions about that, too.
You do. I'm looking at the clock here, and I've also got some comments as well. I was reading something like 1/3 of patients in Philadelphia said, though, that no one had actually contacted them when I guess they had tested positive for the virus, which raises the question about, can we be our own contact tracer? I mean, if we test positive. I mean, if we test positive, you know, we know who we've been in contact over the last you know, week or 10 days. Is it on us to sort of do what a contact tracer maybe isn't able to do?
What a great question. And I think it's true that when the case counts get high, our city doesn't have the capacity we need to keep up with contact tracing. And that's a shame. And that's a national problem. Should people do their own contact tracing? I think lots of institutions do that. And I do think lots of people who have gotten sick are very engaged in calling all the people they've seen to warn them and to tell them. And I think that's so important to have these conversations, because the stigma really about COVID does us all a real disservice. We have to be able to talk about this. This is a virus. People are not intending to transmit it. It's very difficult to control. So yes, I think it's also very normal for people who have been infected to do what I would call lay epidemiology and come up with hypotheses about where they were infected.
Let me read an email from Dave who says, your guest just said that families are determining their own levels of risk-taking that may be more stringent than state mandates. I think this is appropriate. I chose to send my kids to school while other parents opted to go virtual. I think that this balance between personal and state responsibilities, especially here in Pennsylvania, is just about right. Carolyn, I just want to let that sit out there. And here's an email from Gabby. I'm concerned about how cases are being traced and tested. My kids were in in-person school when they went remote due to an outbreak that seems to have originated from unschool-sponsored youth sports. I've heard that a child is a confirmed case of a positive contact, but may not be tested because she is asymptomatic. But how will such a strategy stop this outbreak? I mean, I think that's, she's raising questions about how do you trace something when you can be an asymptomatic spreader of a disease.
Sure. The listener asked a specific question that relates to what we do in contact tracing. The listener said this child was exposed to a known positive person. They were exposed to someone with COVID. We can assume if that child goes on to develop symptoms that they're positive too. If there's a known epidemiological link, we can presume that that second child is also positive. The difficult thing is if, as you said, people remain asymptomatic. If we have a known epidemiological connection, we should strictly quarantine everyone who's been exposed to that person anyway. So whether or not they test, whether they test negative, positive, if you've been a close contact for 2 weeks, stay away from all other people and minimize your contact even with your people in your home. But it is very difficult in school settings, for example, because we don't have widely available frequent testing to catch those asymptomatic cases. And therefore, it is easy to have asymptomatic transmission or pre-symptomatic transmission in settings.
Sure. No, I appreciate your response there. Well, let's talk a little bit about pods. And I know some people have created some pods, and obviously we're looking ahead to cooler weather in the fall. And then, of course, you know, winter arrives and we've got several months of generally bitter cold weather when it is harder to be outside. What should we think about in terms of what is a pod in terms of dealing with this this pandemic, and how do we create one?
The concept of a pod is a small social unit that combines two or more households for social interaction for an extended period of time. The concept of a pod really should be that members of that pod are with one another and excluding from social contact all other people. So they're essentially... I don't know if the word monogamous applies appropriately here, but there's a fidelity sort of between and among the pod members. A general principle is that the smaller the pod is, the easier it's going to be to manage, and the lower the likelihood of exposures of any one of those pod members to COVID in terms of the likelihood of introducing a risk within the pod. I have some guidelines in mind for building them, if you want to hear those.
I do. Sure. I do.
Okay. So first of all, it's important to pick pod mates who have similar concept of risk-taking, risk tolerance, and a similar number of weekly or daily exposures on average. it's difficult to pod up with people who may be much more socially active and to think that you're in any way managing your risk. The sort of highest risk member of your pod represents the risk to your whole pod. The risk level of your whole pod. So assess the level of risk taking, the level of exposure through obligatory activities like work and school, and try to match yourselves up that way. Second, this is a relationship that is going to be a very intimate relationship. It's a relationship that requires a very high degree of trust and transparency in communication. This is not a casual fling. This is a very serious kind of relationship because you're trusting one another with managing exposure to a potentially deadly virus. So it's very serious. So assess risks, then figure out who you really trust. And I think it's important to also really think about who you enjoy. Like, this is about trying to weather this really difficult period and introduce some pleasure that will leaven the very dark days and bring some joy to the members of our household. So I think similar levels of risk-taking, a high degree of trust and transparency, and trying to optimize joy and pleasure given those first two criteria. I think those are important to consider.
Well, I'm all about joy, especially in these troubled times. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And just picking up on that, so in terms of, you talk about trust and transparency, obviously a very important feature of a pod. If someone sort of maybe mistakenly or maybe just without thinking kind of violates the rules of the pod, what's the process of dealing with that?
I encourage people to think about those guidelines for the pod as you're setting it up. One of the things we've all learned through this pandemic is that every day takes a lot of active decision making, and that's very draining for people. And it's especially hard at times of acute stress to make good decisions. So think through, it's going to be very, very normal and expected for people to have to go outside the pod to take care of family members who are ill, for example. They may have to attend to an issue at work, or they may have to travel or have a medical procedure. So people are going to have real life intervene. We can't totally seal ourselves off. So it's important to think through some scenarios. What are we going to do if somebody has to attend a family event, a funeral? What are we going to do if one of the children in the pod has cases of COVID at their school? So think through some of the rainy day scenarios and try to set up some guidelines in advance. I think that can take away some of the tension when the problems arise, because you can refer to your document and say, okay, I really love you. We promised ourselves that if one of the kids had a case of COVID at school, that we were going to take a break and wait to see what happened at the school and with all the children in the pod, and then we would come back together. So think it through in advance.
Sure. And we're almost out of time here. You said document. I mean, should people be signing on a dotted line on this?
I don't know that you have to formalize it to that degree, but I think it does help to try to really clarify where people stand, because I think often we feel like we agree, but then when it comes down to the specifics of, okay, do you feel it's okay to dine inside at a restaurant? Okay, I don't. That's not an acceptable level of risk to me, given the potential benefit. I think it's good to really try to talk through some specifics rather than doing this casually.
Well, you have been so helpful, Carolyn Canusio. Thank you so much for joining us once again on Radio Times.
You're welcome. Be well.
You too. She's an epidemiologist, director of research at the University of Pennsylvania Center for Public Health Initiatives, and she heads up the contact tracing program for Penn Medicine. We began our conversation with Yasmin Abutaleb, health policy reporter for The Washington Post, a kind of a catch-up session on coronavirus. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Artie Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.